This is 4:55 on Friday, September 23rd. All right, good morning.
Quick glance at the calendar. As I said, next Friday is
the first exam. On Wednesday, we will do an exam review. I'm expecting that we will have still some more lecture to do, so it won't just be the exam review. It will be sort of finishing up the chapter as well, given where we are right now. And I will post a sample exam probably after class on Monday, so you can take a look at that ahead of Wednesday and bring any questions about that you might have. The second thing to observe about the calendar is notice that the assignment for Chapter 3, which is what we're talking about right now, is due on Wednesday. That means that there isn't time to grade it and return it to you in time to study with it. So I will post solutions for those on Thursday that you can look. Sorry, I will not post them. I will email them to you on Thursday, because I don't want to post solutions. These websites stay around for a long time, so I don't want to post solutions, but I will email them to you on Thursday. But that also means that there will be no accepted late assignments for that assignment, because I will have sent you the solutions. So that will be that. Why are four people lost at this stage, according to Clix?
Logging into Clix is hard.
All right, so that's that bit of logistics. Next bit of logistics is, in the email that I sent, I suggested using Git to manage your project code, and that got me about how the school has a private GitHub server that you're also welcome to use if you want to, for example, in working with somebody, have a place to share code with them. So people doing senior design, how many of you are there? You guys know all about this, right?
Yeah.
You know how to... You don't know all about this?
I happen to know about it specifically. I specifically looked into it, but in general, it's not something you know about.
Oh, I thought everybody did.
We're in the
Oh, in EE. Okay. The computer science senior design students are doing it. Okay. So in order to use it, you have to log in with your EECS account. Now, how many people don't know their EECS account? What? You don't know the password anymore. So you need to visit the help desk and get that taken care of. But given that... oops. No, not that one either. You can sign in. And if you just look for 455, you'll find two projects, two public projects. A student from last year started to use it but didn't actually do anything for the project, so there's nothing useful there. And then there's mine that has got the header file in it. So, and a git ignore. All right, so that's the same header file that I posted. Now, yeah. Well, I'm about to tell you. So one advantage of using the tool, of using GitHub, would be that if you are working together with someone, it gives you a place to coordinate your activities on the same code base. Okay? So if you change something and somebody else changed something, Git will at least attempt to resolve any differences on you. Between what you changed and what somebody else changed, and let you know of any conflicts if it can't fix them. Apart from that, if you use GitHub as the host for your project and you want to share some code with me, then that's really easy. You don't have to package it up
and send me a big tar file that I then have to unpack. I can just go in and look at it directly in there. This isn't for turning it in, but if you're asking me a question. And then also we could see sort of what you've gone through up to that point. So it could be handy for that. But I'm not requiring you to use this. On the other hand, I really, really want to strongly encourage you to use Git locally. So GitHub is a place, a service, a server that you can store stuff in. But Git is a program that you can use locally. And if you want to use that, you need to sort of investigate the techniques for the workflows associated with Git. It's a very simple workflow that you need. It's just one that says, I made my project, I checked it in, I worked on it some more, I checked it in again, I worked on it some more, I checked it in again, and usually that will be fine, but if you really mess up and you want to go back, you'll have to investigate how to do that. Does anybody have any suggestions about sort of simple tutorial gifts that you've encountered as a result of your use of this in senior design?
There's a lot on YouTube.
The problem is that there's too much in some sense, because what you're after is a tutorial on a very simple workflow. And you don't want to get involved in all the possible things you can do about resolving conflicts between 14 developers and all that stuff. But
I mean, you want a really simple one, the one on Code Academy is pretty
good. Code Academy.
Code Academy. Simple. Well, Git command line stuff. Yeah, that's good. And then on the GitHub site itself, I believe there are some tutorials. If not on our GitHub, then on the public Git one. Oh, the other thing I need to say is, if you use the GitHub for your project, make sure that you make it a private repository, because if you don't, it will be anybody in the class or anybody else in the ECS will be able to go in and see your code. And we don't want that. Okay? So make yours a private repository. Mine is public because I wanted to share it with all of you. Yeah?
Do you care if we use the ECS private GitHub versus the public GitHub?
So the problem with the public GitHub is that I believe unless you pay them money, you can't make them private. Okay? And so your code would be public, and then anybody could see it, and that would not be a good thing for an assignment at this stage. Andrew might know something like
that. The ECS GitHub server allows you to have unlimited private repos.
Right, exactly. That's the point for using this, is that it lets you have private repos.
And when we want you to look at our code, how do we add you as a collaborator? Like, what's your...
You can... Oh, my name is Hauser. Okay, right. So a private repository you can share with specific users. And mine is Hauser, which you can actually see there as part of it. Okay? So just a suggestion, one of the things that we're wanting to do as a school is make students more aware of tools like this sort of throughout your education, and this is sort of the end of your, typically for most of you, the end of your time here, and we should be teaching you about this stuff in CS 121 instead, but we're working on that. Okay. All right. I think that's all I wanted to say about that. Any other questions about that? I use Git just locally anytime I start a project. Well, I try to use Git anytime I start a project. I don't always remember, and then I end up regretting because I make a change and break something and wish I could go back. At which point, I remember that I really should be using Git. There are other sort of command line simple version control systems that are used. Mercurial is one, generally known as version control systems. ECS. SVN is another one. SVN is has not got as quite nice a model, I think, as Git and Mercurial do. But Git is what we're using around here. All right, let's go on. I have some clicks questions this morning. Alright, suppose I want a single server that can serve requests over both HTTP on port 80 and HTTPS on port 443. To do this, what would I need? We have a strong opinion emerging that I should create two stream sockets, one bound to each port, and listen on both of them. Is there any issue about listening on both ports from one program? What?
I don't know.
You don't know. Well, how does it go, right? How does the flow go, right? It goes socket, bind, listen, accept, send, and receive, right? And suppose I listen on one socket. Can I listen on another socket without any trouble? Can I call, in some sense this means, can I call listen on another socket? Sure, why not? Listen is one of those system calls that immediately returns. So I can listen on one, and then I can listen on another one, and there will be no problem.
Wrong. This one. Okay, after creating the two stream sockets and listening on both of them, as in the previous question, the code would then have to do what as the next step? So, alternately calling receive on the two sockets. What comes after listen in the flow? What's the next thing after listen? Accept, not receive. Okay, so that's not right. Alternately call accept on the two sockets. Okay, so this is interesting. Lots of people answer that. Somehow, C is clearly wrong because it's about a receive, and D is about simultaneously calling. So D is actually the correct answer, but it's not obvious that it's the correct answer unless we talk about why it's the correct answer. So what happens if I alternately call accept on, say, the port 80 socket and the port 443 socket? Right. I will have to have an HTTP connection before I can do an HTTPS connection, and then I will have to have one of those before I can do the next HTTP connection. And that doesn't seem like a good behavior for a server, right? Because the clients out there, they don't know what other clients are doing. So why would we expect them to alter? So that's not too satisfactory. Which leaves us with D, simultaneously
call accept on both sockets. And I haven't told you how to do that, right? Which is why it's somehow because if we call accept on one socket, we've got to get a connection on that socket before we can go on. So we will get to the how to do that simultaneous business
a little later in the semester. But I wanted you to think about that issue right now. Next one.
After successfully accepting a connection, the server would send and receive on the listing socket, send and receive on the bound socket, send and receive on the socket returned by accept, or send and receive on the socket returned by connect.
Good. We have consensus pretty much.
Send and receive on the socket returned by accept. Absolutely. The listening socket and the bound socket are the original socket that was returned by socket, right? And that's not the one that's used for send and receive. It's the one used returned by accept.
Okay. So good. And last one. How about on the client side? After successfully connecting to the server, the client would unfortunately, the consensus here is wrong.
God damn.
Send and receive on the listening socket. No, the client doesn't do any listening on a socket, so that's got to be wrong. Send and receive on the socket returned by connect. Does connect return a socket? No. Sorry. So, the point of this question was to sort of illustrate that the server and client behavior is a little bit asymmetric, right? The client uses that original socket returned by the socket system call and connects it to the server with the connect call. Whereas the server takes the original socket, returned by socket, binds and listens on it, and then gets new sockets returned by accept. Right? So,
just trying to keep you on your toes about the details of these semantics. Okay, any questions about this? This was apparently useful review. Given what I saw. What? What is a socket? Is a system call? Yeah. Okay. Then I think we are done with this. I just wanted to point out one other thing. In both Windows and in Linux and on Mac. There is a command called netstat. And if you pass it the flags N and A, well, we'll pass N and A to begin with, and then we'll try something different. N and A, you will get a big long list of sockets
And notice how it tells you which protocol, TCP. It tells you the local address consisting of both the IP address, and remember all zeros means essentially any interface that I happen to have. The foreign address for listening, the state is listening, so it's listen has been called on that socket. Foreign address means we don't care. Anybody? And so it just tells you what those are. Those are all the listening ones. And then it will tell you about the ones that are connected, that is established, connected, except have both been called. And it tells you the local end and remote end, IP addresses, and port numbers on both sides. Then come a bunch of ones. These are IP version 6 addresses, and this one sort of corresponds to the all zeros in IP version 4. It means any address. Port numbers are the same, and those are listening, so this machine has some IPv6 support. Then there's a bunch of UDP stuff. So a UDP socket, datagram socket, is open, and it's essentially bound to that address. That's something you can do with UDP sockets, right? Just bind them to an address. The remote end doesn't have any binding, typically, for UDP sockets, and say for IP version 6. Okay, so that's a handy command. You might find it useful during your project to make sure, for example, that the server is actually listening on the port you think it's listening on, and not some other one due to a failure to call H to NS on the port number before calling bind, for example. It's a typical mistake, right? If you end up listening on the wrong port. So that can help. If you don't pass the N flag, I think what it does is tell you the IP addresses. The names of remote things. So... I don't know what some of those names are. Kind of disturbing. Kind of disturbing that I should have connections to some of those names. But what?
At least NSA is.
That would be more comforting in some ways than some of these ones that I'm saying here. Let's see. MSN bot.
Yeah.
Is perhaps disturbing. Okay. Well, anyway. Just wanted to point that out. Okay. Are we ready to go on then talking about our state machines that we were last time and how to do reliable data transfer? Yeah,
so
go ahead.
You get on different IP addresses depending on the sockets. That's what it
shows
you.
Okay. So... Yeah, that's worth pointing out. The all zeros one is any interface this machine has. The 127.0.0.1, remember I told you about that last time in the context of the project, that means just this machine. Okay? So these are actually pretty safe in a lot of ways. We know that the only connections that can be made to these ports are ones that come from this machine itself. Whereas these could come from any machine anywhere because we're listening on not only the 127.0.0.1 address, but also our wireless network interface, which has this address. So where were we? We were talking about state machines.
So, as I recall, this is about where we were last time. We were seeing, we were prepared to handle what problem with this state machine? Remember, we're doing reliable transfer over an unreliable link. And I said that unreliability could be of several different kinds, and we would have to sort of work up to all the possible kinds. So what could we handle with this one? What kind of unreliability? Anybody remember? No. This one only handled the possibility that a packet would be delivered corruptly. It would be delivered, but it might be delivered corruptly. And when it was delivered corruptly, the recipient would send back a NAC, negative acknowledgement. Okay. And given that, the sender would, upon receiving a NAC, would repeat again the packet that was sent that was received correctly. And the claim is that this ought to reliably transfer data over this unreliable link. Does it work? Anybody see any problems with this? There is a problem. Yes.
Is there no final state?
No. The how does the state machine get set up and torn down is a separate issue.
Okay.
Just worrying about reliable data transfer. Anybody see something of concern here? Well, there is no timer, but a timer is a solution to a problem. We don't have the problem yet. Yeah?
It doesn't handle drop.
It doesn't handle drop packets, but we weren't trying to do that quite yet. We'll get there. If the channel can corrupt packets in the forward direction, it can also corrupt packets in the backward direction. Right? So, suppose that the packet is corrupt. That ACK or NAC is corrupt. It's neither an ACK or a NAC. What should we do? What do you think? Yeah.
Send a NAC back.
Send a NAC back. that seems like a plausible thing to do. What would we have to do over here to handle that? Is this state machine prepared to receive a NAC? No, it has no rule about what it's supposed to do with a NAC. So we would have to extend it with another transition here that told us what it was supposed to do when it received a NAC. And I guess what it would be supposed to do is, depending whether it had previously sent an ACK or an ACK, send it again. Okay? Seems plausible. I don't know. We'd have to analyze it. The point of this little discussion is something very simple, sort of leads down a rat hole.
as far as analyzing whether this works or not, which is why before we get to the more complicated things, I want to talk about this. What other things might you think of doing if you received a corrupt ACK or NACK here? How about treating it as a NACK? Does that cross anybody's mind as something that you might do? No? Yeah. We've got to focus on what we have here, okay? So this state machine doesn't have that feature, okay? It's just an ACK or an ACK. We'll get there. We'll definitely get there. But this one doesn't have that. So what would happen if, upon receiving a corrupted ACK or NACK, we treated it as a NACK? Okay, so if isNAC or isCorrupt reset, what would that cause to happen over on this side? We'd resend the packet, we'd assume that it, we'd be in a state, it's not corrupt, we would extract it, and we would deliver an ACK. But what if we had previously sent an ACK for that ACK? Right. Nothing said. The fact that we got a corrupt packet here, it might have been an ACK packet, or it might have been an ACK packet. Right. If it was an ACK packet and we resend it, what have we just done? We put two copies of that piece of data into the data stream. That's wrong. If it was originally an ACK packet, it would be okay. But either possibility can occur. So I like this solution better of extending the protocol with a NACK coming back rather than resending the packet and saying, you tell me again what your was. Yeah?
On like the real machine, is there like a point where it just times out and receives the configuration?
We'll get there. Okay, we'll get there. Oh, yes, all right. All this crud. Okay. So, we had one solution, which was to ACK or NACK the bad packet. Another solution, which is that, as you suggested, we add a sequence number to every packet. And if the receiver gets a duplicate, it knows it's a duplicate now and doesn't deliver it upward. We haven't produced a duplication of data within the data stream. It all would be well. Okay. We'll talk more about sequence numbers. So this leads to a protocol that is known as stop and wait, in which the sender sends one packet to the receiver, waits for a successful ACK for that packet, and then goes on to the next packet. Right? And so we have a state machine for that. And the sequence number now is just one bit for stop and wait. So we start in this state, and the first time we get data from above, remember RDT send is the thing from a call from above that triggers the transition. We send the data with sequence number 0, and then we wait for an ACK, a successful ACK, that says I got packet 0. And once we do that, we move to a state where we're waiting another call from above, we send that packet with sequence number one, and we just go back and forth between these two states.
On the sender side.
And similarly, on the receiver side, we wait for zero, then we wait for one, we go back and forth between those. When we get one successfully, we send an ACK for that packet, and then we move on to waiting for the next one.
Okay, so this is stop and wait. And it is reliable in this context of a channel that doesn't drop packets. What happens if a channel drops a packet in this scenario? Just think about what the state machines say. You can tell from what the state machine says. What happens if a packet from the sender to the receiver, that is a data packet, is not delivered here?
If he has a sequence number, or if it just has sequence.
What? We won't ever get that far because, yeah.
If they never receive the packet, they won't send a reply.
Exactly. Look at the specification of this state machine. If it doesn't receive something, it doesn't do anything. So if a packet is dropped, this state machine will never make any more progress. It's stuck. And similarly, on the other side, if an ACK is dropped, ACK or NAC is dropped, that state machine makes no progress because there's nothing that causes any state transitions except receipt of a packet. And there's only ever one packet outstanding at a time, so if that packet is lost, the whole thing comes to a screeching halt. So what do we do about that? We're going to need some timeout. Right, to say, I expect to have an answer back from having sent something, and it hasn't happened, so I'm going to do it again. Alright,
I'm going to do something to recover from that. We covered that.
So this is just a little trick that it's at this age it seems a little silly, but instead of having a NAC, we only have ACKs. If the ACKs contain the sequence number of the last successfully received packet, and so if the sender gets an ACK for something that it didn't send, then it knows that it didn't that packet didn't make it, and it knows to resend it. And it seems silly at this stage, but when we talked about how TCP is actually implemented, it's going to use this technique, a generalization of this technique. So let's just point out that possibility. Okay, so if we can lose packets, as we said, this will not be enough. So we need to have some timeouts. And so our stop and wait state machine serves as a good basis for this. We'll just add some transitions based on timeouts that will sort of force things to make some progress. And again, because it's stop and wait, and we only have one packet outstanding at a time, we will succeed in this, and it will still be correct. All right.
And I don't know. You can go through the things.
there are a lot of cases to consider, right, as to whether this is correct or not. You know,
like, is it an act that's lost? Is it an act that's lost? Well, we're using Act 0 and Act 1 here. Is it an act that's lost? Is it a packet that's lost? Is it a packet that's delayed for too long and therefore causes a timeout even though ultimately the packet is delivered correctly? Right? All of those are possibilities that have to be considered and have been in the design of these RDP protocols.
Now, correct, but the performance stinks, and I think that is more easily seen on this slide than on the last one. So we're back to these space-time diagrams, and just let's review what they mean. Time progresses down, space, linear space, goes across, and so when I start to send a packet here, I transmit for a while, right? That's the packet sort of at the sender. That's what it looks like. I send for a while and then I stop. And that packet transitions over the wire as a bunch of bits and eventually arrives at the receiver. And again, it takes some time from the first bit to the last bit to be received. And once that happens, then we send a very small act, so we don't even send it, show its width in blue, but it will be very small. And it takes some time going down for that to traverse the distance that it gets here. And on this time axis, we ask about the utilization of the link. For what fraction of the time are we actually transmitting data on the link? Well, it's just this blue segment here, right? During this time we transmitted, and then we were finished transmitting the packet, and then we had to wait for the acknowledgement to come back, and then we sent the next packet. Okay? Thus, the name stop and wait. Okay? We send something and then we wait until the ACK arrives and we start again. Okay? So utilization then is the fraction of time that there's blue along this line. And if you look at what that is, you see that this is the round trip time, right, from the last bit until the receipt of the ACK, plus the time that it took to transmit the packet, and that gives us a utilization of L over R, L the packet length, R the transmission rate, and RTT is the round trip time, the time that it takes to go over there. And you figure that out, and in the example on the previous slide, which we had a gigabit network, utilization is 0.027%. Right? In other words, 0.0027. Well, that's not a very satisfactory situation. If that's what it takes in order to be able to have reliable data transfer. So what do we have to do in order to get better utilization? What do you think? Pipeline is exactly the right word for this. We need to be able to send out multiple packets without having had an acknowledgement for the first one. I mean, that's the whole problem here, right? We send one and then we wait for its acknowledgement. That's not going to work if we want to get better utilization of this period of time. We have to be able to send packets that we don't have acknowledgements for. And to accomplish that, we have to have
more sequence numbers, right? A one-bit sequence number is no longer enough. We're going to have more sequence numbers. I think one of the homework problems is, how many sequence numbers do we have to have? Okay, so you'll have to figure that out. So, this is stop and wait. This is our pipelined version. So in the pipelined version, we have a whole bunch of data packets flowing on the blue arrow, and we have a whole bunch of ACK packets flowing on the green arrow, bonding to data that has already been received here. And it takes some time to go both directions. And now, we've got to come back to that chapter one discussion we had about bandwidth delay product. Remember I emphasized the bandwidth delay product back in chapter one? What's going on? How much data does the sender have to be willing to have outstanding? That is, unacknowledged, in order to make this fully work. Think about it. It has to sort of totally fill up that direction and totally fill up that direction. So the round trip time times the transmission rate, the bandwidth delay product, tells us how much data the sender must be willing to have outstanding and unacknowledged. And that's why it's important, because that number is going to enter into the design of the protocol on this end, about how many sequence numbers we have to have. Okay?
So once we do that, we start to have more packets outstanding and we start to increase the utilization. Now, I just want to point out that it's a little tricky in the homework. You have to be careful that you're applying this formula correctly in the homework. It's not always the case that, it won't always be 3L over R, right? Because the 3 here happens to come from the design of this particular protocol that lets us have 3 packets outstanding. Okay? So, with that, I think I'll stop, and next time we'll talk about some variations on the details of this pipeline protocol called Go Back In and Selective Repeat, and then I think we will talk about congestion. Oh, then we will talk about TCP. And once we talk about TCP, then we will talk about congestion. All right? So, I will see you on Monday. Get to work on that project. It will help you with the exam, I'm sure.